Court of Appeals. This is our second case scheduled for oral argument this morning, September 15th, 2021. The case is State of Minnesota versus Alexander Viktorovich Leluk. And I'm probably butchering that last name. I will hear from respondents' counsel as to my pronunciation shortly. The case number is A210699. And counsel, just a few remarks before we begin with your arguments. Today's session and argument is being audio recorded, and the recording of the argument will be available to the public shortly on the court's website. If we experience any Zoom glitches, we will pause the argument and resume once we have an opportunity to be all together again, assuming that happens within a reasonable amount of time. You, I think, are both familiar with the time rules, and your time will be monitored and counted down by our marshal on the screen that both of you should be able to see. My last request is that you please both identify yourself and the party you represent before you begin with your argument. Those conclude my remarks. We're now ready to hear from counsel for the appellant. You may begin.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler, and I represent the appellant, State of Minnesota. This is a state's pretrial appeal. As such, the state must show clearly and unequivocally that the district court ruling was erroneous and that the ruling will have a critical impact on the state's case. Findings of fact are reviewed for clear error. Legal determinations are reviewed de novo. In respondent's brief, respondent concedes the critical impact element, so that's not an issue that needs to be addressed. And respondent concedes that the district court's order contains clearly erroneous facts, but simply asserts that they're irrelevant. Clearly erroneous facts, in this case, not irrelevant. The facts determine what the officer and this court can consider when determining whether exigent circumstances existed. So respondent asserts that there's no finding on when the LPR data was requested. And that's true. There's no specific finding of that. And the district court's order actually places it after police were receiving live updates that the vehicle was driving to the reservation, which demonstrates why these facts are not irrelevant, why they all matter.
Can I pause you just for a moment, just for one big picture observation? It seems that neither party has raised the issue of whether suppression of evidence is the remedy for a violation of the statute. It seems the state, I assume, is conceding that point.
No, this actually is raising that in argument three, which is exactly that, Judge, that issue was not specifically presented to the district court, but should have been. So the district court was not presented with the option to consider the fact that if there is a violation of the statute, there's more option than to either suppression or nothing.
Well, I guess that's the framing of my question, maybe more specific. The issue is raised here, never raised in the district court. So the concession was made in the district court.
I don't know if the concession was made, but the issue wasn't raised. So all that was argued in the district court was whether there were exigent circumstances or not, not what should therefore happen if there are or there are not.
Right. So just to be clear, I mean, what's the basis for us not treating that issue as forfeited?
As not forfeited?
Yes.
It's obviously, the state's arguing that issue is not forfeited. We are raising it here, and the court can and often does raise issues for the first time on appeal. So most recently in McDonald versus Brad court, this court say that the rule is flexible and we may review forfeited issues as the interests of justice require. I'm well aware that in Brad Corb, you then went on and found the issue was forfeited, but the point is you can reach them. And in this case, you should reach that issue, or at the very least, remand it to the district court so the district court has an option to consider that issue.
Do you have any authority to support the proposition that this court can consider whether suppression is an appropriate or warranted remedy when that issue was never raised below?
I don't have a specific case, but there's, I mean, many of the cases, when the court addresses these issues, they find that not all issues are forfeited. It can be raised, particularly in the interest of justice, particularly when the opposing party is not prejudiced.
And whose burden was it to raise the question of remedy in the district court?
It's the state's burden to prove exigency. It would probably have been a good idea for the state to raise this issue as well. I'm not sure about the actual burden on that point, but I would, again, ask this court to address it in the interest of justice, since no party is prejudiced in this case. It's not fact-specific. It's simply a legal issue. It's been addressed on appeal by both parties.
But you call it a technical violation in Part C of your brief, right?
Correct.
So if it's a technical violation, why would we, in the interest of justice, take it up if you didn't raise it below?
Because it goes to the remedy of what should happen in this case. And in the interest of justice, this court can, and I would urge it to address the issue, at the very least, if nothing else, to remand it to give the district court an opportunity to address it in the first instance. Because unquestionably, there are clearly erroneous facts. And those clearly erroneous facts unquestionably are relevant to whether there was exigency or not. Because of that, because there is no prejudice to the respondent, I would ask the court to address that issue. Going back to the erroneous, to the factual issues, there's also no finding on when respondent Mr. LaLuke became the subject of an active criminal investigation and therefore subject to the exigent circumstances requirement in the first instance. So there are a number of facts that are problematic and some that are simply wrong.
I'm not sure I understand that argument. It seems to me that if the district court's findings were accurate, it feels like more of a flavor of exigency than if the lack of these timing considerations were ever properly before the district court. So I was a little bit lost in your argument as to how the error that you say occurred in the fact-finding would actually assist the state's position that there was an exigency.
Well, the statute says an automated license plate reader must not be used to monitor or track an individual who is the subject of an active criminal investigation unless authorized by a warrant issued upon probable cause or exigent circumstances justify its use. So the part of who is the subject of an active criminal investigation could be as late as when he was identified at the gas station, or could be as early as when his license plate was identified at Spring Lake Park at the very beginning, or could be somewhere in the middle. The respondent is arguing that the relevant time period is when the LPR was requested by the officer, which would be somewhere in the middle. But in any case, the district court's findings actually place it while the officer is getting real-time data that this vehicle is still driving through the reservation.
Right, but if we're taking a de novo review of it, of this legal question, I'm at a loss for why the investigation wouldn't be considered. As soon as you get a report to the police, that of a potential drunk driver leaving the scene, and the officers start to try to find that drunk driver, hasn't the investigation begun at that point? I would think the state would believe so.
An investigation has begun, but that is not exactly what the LPR statute addresses. So the LPR statute doesn't come into play until its terms are satisfied. So it can't be used to monitor or track an individual. Well, at that point, when the police began their investigation, they weren't monitoring or tracking an individual. They didn't know who they were looking for at that point. And specifically, it has to be the statute, and I quote, who is the subject of an active criminal investigation. They hadn't identified anybody at that point. They were responding to the report of reckless driving, beer cans falling out, and somebody scared to even approach the vehicle.
So are you arguing, I just want to make sure I'm understanding your argument. Are you arguing that this provision is more akin to, I can't remember the exact statute number, 626A something concerning tracking warrants, so that a warrant is only required if future conduct is being tracked or an individual is being monitored, as opposed to collection of past information?
Hadn't thought that through. That might make some analogous sense. My point more, though, is that this is the warrant or exigent circumstances are only required here because the statute says so. This is not a constitutional violation in any case. I mean, that's never been claimed or argued. So it's only a statutory violation. The only reason that any of the constitutional analysis comes into play is because the legislature used the term exigent circumstances and the warrant requirement. So it sort of comes into a hybrid analysis, but the constitutional factors come into play because the legislature incorporated them by stating exigent circumstances. That's where the argument comes, and that's where the district court went through the exigency analysis. I'm not sure if that answered the court's question or not. The exigent circumstances, that is not a defined term per se in the statute. That is a defined term in constitutional, obviously. The district court considered one of the highest levels of exigency that needed to enter a home to execute a warrant. But that's not at all what happened here. So this statute requires exigency, but it doesn't then address, it requires what police are doing, but it doesn't require why police are doing it. It left maximum flexibility in that. So police can request LPR data for a variety of reasons and in a variety of different situations. The legislature didn't need to foresee it all. It simply went with the exigency requirement.
And just again, I don't mean to throw a weird question at you, but are you suggesting that that a court doesn't need to apply the exigency analysis that has been adopted for constitutional purposes in determining whether there are exigent circumstances for the purpose of this statute?
No, I'm saying that that's exactly what the court does. However, that's the totality of the circumstances. And that totality in Dorman, which is what the district court went with, but really none of those factors are required, nor are any of them alone sufficient. It's the totality of the circumstances that the court looks at.
Are they all relevant? I was concerned that we're looking at Dorman v. United States, and we're looking at Minnesota's Gray Supreme Court decision, where the question there is the state, the police authority to go into someone's home, which seems to be weightier than seeing where someone's car is traveling. So I'm not sure that all those factors really apply.
And I agree completely. And Dorman itself and Minnesota cases, you know, applying Dorman also say exactly that. None of these factors are required. And if you went through each one, which is what the district court did in this case, it's kind of trying to put a square peg in a round hole or vice versa. It doesn't fit. In this case, the privacy interest is so low, but the legislature determined that there is a privacy interest by requiring this determination. But the privacy interest is so low, it's not entering a home, it's not searching a person, it's not even searching a vehicle. As Judge Ross indicated and had argued in the state's brief, it's simply comparing a database. The police intrusion is low. The police reason for the request was high. So under the totality of the circumstances, there was exigency.
Let me ask you this. So then if... do you think that operating a vehicle, we'll just assume that the driver was drunk, that the respondent was drunk and driving. We'll assume that. Do you think that that in and of itself is a grave or violent offense?
I I think that it can certainly, yes, it could.
It's the potential, but the case law that we look at, like Gray involved an execution style murder, or Olson involved murder and assault, Hummel involved murder, those are things that were happening. And they weren't just the possibility of a murder, they actually were murders and assaults. And so you're saying that the potentiality of it makes it grave or violent?
I do. Under the totality of circumstances, I think that that's exactly right. And I recognize that the respondent is also arguing that you can't rely on just the potential for great violence. There has to actually be great violence, that the police have to...
that's my next question. Do you have case law that says the potentiality that there's going to be a hit, a murder, a criminal vehicular homicide or something as a result of drunk driving? Do you have a case that states that?
I don't have a case that says exactly that as directly as I would like it to, but I do cite cases like Bingham City and like Reese versus State, where the United States Supreme Court and the Minnesota Court of Appeals say, you don't have to wait for even greater violence to occur. Police can't intervene early. They're not boxing or hockey referees waiting to stop a bout only if it becomes one-sided. So I would rely on those cases. And with that, I would defer until...
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Zettler. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Next, we will turn to counsel for the respondent. Let's get the time up there. Okay, you may proceed, Mr. Nyvold.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Mark Nyvold, representing respondent Lel Yuk. And Judge Gaitis, yes, your pronunciation is as good as a non-native speaker could get to. So I first want to address the way the state tries to minimize the privacy or just basically disregard it at all. You know, in their brief, they keep describing this as all that's at issue here is looking at a picture of a license plate. When these plate readers, they take pictures. That's not the issue. They take pictures continuously. Every time it goes by a plate reader, there's a series of pictures and they track the location. The state wants to gloss over that it's not just, oh, everybody can look at it and see what the license plate number is. It's tracking one's whereabouts. What would we think if the moment we got up in the morning, the state was tracking everywhere we went and making that available to law enforcement, just in case? Okay, maybe we want to reconstruct a crime. We want to find out where everybody was at one point.
Well, Mr. Nyvold,
that's really what the state is getting at.
Without trying to assume what either of my colleagues think about your argument, I think your position is certainly well taken on the point that this is more of an intrusion than the state is suggesting. If you have this tracking technology available, in fact, it's probably more intrusive than having someone follow you around because it is sort of foolproof. Everywhere you go, it records where you are and the time you're there. My trouble with your argument, though, goes to the nature of the danger, the idea that this crime hasn't, implicit in your argument, like sort of the danger hasn't really occurred. We've got a witness saying that there's a person who appears to be drunk, they're driving recklessly, and it's an ongoing, present danger. So I think it differs from those cases where we're talking about whether there is it's a serious offense because murder has occurred. We're talking about a law enforcement officer's attempt to stop a harm that hasn't occurred, but the danger is, in fact, it seems to me, at least urgent. You've got a car, presumably a drunk driver. It's happening now. It's happening at a time of day when there are people around, and it was in a park, so there's sort of a disregard for safety. So focus your argument on that concern, if you would.
Well, I would get back to what the reports were, Your Honor. First of all, when this car pulls into the parking lot at the Spring Lake Park Reserve, yes, it's supposedly going at a fast rate of speed. Okay, but there wasn't any report of others being around or anyone being near the car when it came in. It just someone sees it come in and that's all they saw. So it was driving fast through a parking lot.
Well, through a parking lot, but it was a park. And I think the term that was used was recklessly.
Well, that's a relative term. Now, this person who saw it may have been exaggerating, but that's not unusual behavior. I mean, we all see cars roaring through parking lots or exceeding the speed limit on streets. We don't say, call the cops. This guy might hit somebody in the next few miles or next few minutes.
Well, perhaps, but when the person gets out of the car and a bunch of empty beer cans fall out, and the person apparently is, we know later, of course, just how intoxicated he was, unable to stand on his own without leaning against the car. I mean, this is the report doesn't say that. The report just says reckless, got out of the car, beer cans fell out. So it's not just a fast-moving car, and it's not just a car that's reportedly recklessly driving. It's the location and the circumstances seem to be a little bit more than you're suggesting.
Well, again, as to the location, there is no report of anyone being near the car or the observer thinking, oh, someone was close and might have gotten hit. So there's no real basis to believe that anyone was around in danger. The observer didn't say he felt he was in danger. He's just viewing it from afar. But be that as it may, the basis of Fourth Amendment review is an incremental approach. You look at what the facts are, and you don't automatically go from there's a suspicion here to, oh, that means it's probable cause or exigent circumstances. That's what they had was a basis for obviously trying to find the vehicle and determine whether there was driving under the influence. But you don't jump to that conclusion. You've got a suspicion. And Your Honor, I think the danger here is to go from, well, there was a suspicion that this might happen to, well, the police have to be able to address that as if that were imminent. You've got to have an imminent a basis for believing that harm or death is imminent. That's what the exigency here would have to be. You don't have that. All they had was a basis to try to find the car and stop it once they found it. All right, but they shortcut that. They go to Mystic Lake. They don't even use their own system. They're going to the Mystic Lake Police Department. Give us the plate reader data for this. They don't have an adequate basis for that. They don't have probable cause. They don't have exigent circumstances. I mean, can anyone say that based on what was observed in the parking lot, there was probable cause to believe the drunk driving had occurred? I don't think so. You had a basis to investigate. And maybe you would have, if they'd done things by the book, they might have been able to make that case.
When you say by the book, you mean going and getting a warrant?
Well, getting a warrant but definitely not using plate reader data without exigent circumstances. This isn't it's already been discussed. This wasn't a grave or violent offense.
You agree, don't you, that drunk drivers do pose a grave danger to other motorists and pedestrians on the roadway?
That's this argument the state makes, and they want to basically ask the court to jump to the conclusion that that's what was occurring here. We don't know that.
That's what was being investigated here, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, but how do you investigate it? Do you have exigent circumstances to justify getting plate reader data? Not based on what they knew. I mean, that just takes it too far. It just essentially converts every suspicion of DWI to probable cause and exigent circumstances. It's questionable whether they could have even gotten a warrant based on this. And, you know, what the state is just dying for is to be able to use this plate reader data for real-time use just routinely. And the statute does not allow that. They go so far as in their brief to say, well, this is real-time use is permissible.
Does the statute require probable cause or just exigent circumstances?
I believe it's probable cause and exigent circumstance, or a warrant. It requires a warrant and exigent circumstances. And well, you've got to have probable cause for the warrant.
Well, it says, right, you have to have probable cause for a warrant, but it says, or exigent circumstances, not probable cause with.
I'm sorry. Yes. Yes. It's alternative. Right. But they didn't have a warrant. Now, did they have exigent circumstances? Well, where's the grave offense? It's just.
But just to be clear, you had mentioned earlier that there has to be probable cause and exigent circumstances.
I'm sorry. Yes, I stand corrected. Okay. I stand corrected. But they didn't have either. But, you know, they're not even being accurate. They say, actually, the requirement is that license plate readers must not be used to monitor or track an individual who is the subject of an active criminal investigation. That's coming right from 13.824 subdivision 2D, the statute. So they want this court to give them the leeway to read into the statute or to apply the statute in a way that's directly prohibited by the statute. So,
well, I think their argument, and I may be glossing it too much, but is there a difference between tracking an individual and tracking the individual's car as you see the statute applied?
Well, if someone's got to be in the car, if they're, you know, for them to track it.
Right, but it's an individual who is the subject of an active criminal investigation. What if, you know, you don't know who the individual is, you're just investigating to see whether whoever is driving the car, unknown, is in fact a danger. Does that trigger the statute or not?
Whoever was driving the car was an individual subject to an active criminal investigation. There's no question about that. They had the report from the person in the parking lot. The officer went to they even knew who it was. They went to his home first to see if he'd gone there. They don't find him there. And, you know, then they request the plate reader data without having, either getting a search warrant or having exigent circumstances. And the state's argument would basically change the nature of exigent circumstances to include reasonable suspicion. The law just doesn't, you can't take that doctrine and dilute it that much and call it exigent circumstances anymore. So
now our rules provide an opportunity for parties to indicate a preference, a belief, whether a decision should be precedential or non-precedential. And I don't know that the parties in this case both responded to that opportunity. I wonder if if you take a position as to whether our decision one way or the other should be precedential.
I'll let the appellant go first.
I think the question was directed specifically to you, Mr. Nyvold.
Oh, all right. I'm sorry, Judge Ross. Well, at risk of sounding too tongue-in-cheek, it would be helpful to know which way the court is going to rule. That's the reality of it. I have to.
Yeah, if you're going to win, you want a precedential opinion. If you're going to lose, you don't. That's fair enough.
Yes. Well, let me put it this way. If the court says that the plate reader data was not validly obtained here, that should be precedent. Okay. I don't think there's any question about that. This is an important matter. I think the police are doing this all the time. They're finding ways to get this data. That's why they want to be able to legitimize what I think is, to one extent or the other, a practice by the police. It's just too tempting, you know. It's just too easy to make that phone call. And look what they did here. They didn't even have to go through their own department and make a record of it. They call Mystic Lake and have their law enforcement office or agency get them the data. This is insidious. It's just what's going on here, and we don't even know about it. So it's clear they didn't have probable cause, or they didn't have a search warrant, and they didn't have probable cause to get one. And I realize that you know, they're trying to find a drunk driver, but you can't shortcut the process they want to do it.
You seem again to be implying that we should read into the exigency requirement a probable cause component to it, as opposed to just exigent circumstances on its own. It could be exigent to why isn't an exigency in order to continue the investigation enough, as opposed to an exigency that a crime has already been committed? At least that's the way the statute was written. It seems to me the legislature could have said what you're implying, but didn't.
Well, the two are not the same. You've got, you know, what are called the dormant factors, and they don't equate to probable cause. They don't track probable cause. Let me see. For example, you're looking at, is there a grave or violent offense? Is the suspect believed armed? And in fact, one of the factors is, does strong probable cause exist? So that's part of the analysis, but it's not all of it.
So can I just ask, do you believe the probable cause finding is embedded in the exigent circumstances requirement, that it has to be actually both probable cause and exigent circumstances? And with exigent circumstances, you're simply excused from the judicial pre-authorization?
Well, in the dormant factors, the one relating to probable cause asks, does strong probable cause exist? So just probable cause by itself might not be enough. It has to be strong. So it's even goes beyond probable cause. It's tougher than that.
So just to be clear, would you agree with me that there has to be probable cause if you're going to rely on exigent circumstances? So it actually, there is a requirement for both probable cause and an exigency.
Well, Your Honor, I tend to agree, but what gives me pause is I don't remember if I don't think all of the factors have to exist. That's the thing. So if they're going to consider proceeding without a warrant, it's supportive that there isn't strong that there's strong probable cause. I think you know, typically you're going to need more than just a suspicion than to proceed with or to get exigent circumstances.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think a mere suspicion will ever cut it in saying it was exigent circumstances. And that's what we have here. We just had a suspicion of drunk driving. Where's the exigency? I mean, where's the strong probable cause?
Mr. Nyvold, you are out of time.
Thank you.
Would you like to make a statement to wrap up, or are you finished with your argument?
No, I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Mr. Zettler, back to you. You do have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Judge, no case that I'm aware of requires probable cause in addition to exigent circumstances. That's the point of exigent circumstances. So it may be an additional factor thrown in under Dorman or whatnot, but it is not a separate additional requirement. And in this case, this was July 25th at 6:53 p.m., so still complete daylight. And this driver comes into the park so fast, parks recklessly, parks crooked, gets out, beer cans are falling out. It almost reads like a Cheech and Chong type movie, except it's not funny because this person is actually afraid. He's taking photographs of the skid marks. He's taking photographs of the license plate, and he's calling 911. This isn't a normal response, and this isn't a normal driving conduct. This was something serious and significant. So respondent obviously minimizes it. That's their job. But this was a serious concern and a serious violation, and the police responded completely appropriately. Respondent argues that there is a great right to privacy here. There's not. There is no constitutional right to privacy at issue here. There is a statutory right that has been enacted. But this is not a constitutional violation.
Well, it may not be constitutional, but the legislature, it seems to me, acting on behalf of the people of Minnesota, have a concern about law enforcement using electronic tracking mechanisms. And so even though it is not a constitutional issue, I'm not sure I find, again, speaking on my own behalf, not for my fellow panel members, it seems you're being rather dismissive with the degree of intrusiveness that the legislature is trying to curb.
And I'm not trying to be dismissive and make it lighter than it is or should be, but it is a statutory right. It is not a constitutional right. You have no right to privacy in driving around. Now, I get that the United States Supreme Court has reached different conclusions with the, and the concern here actually was this conglomeration and amalgamation and collection of data, massive amounts of data on people, and eventually that can cross the line and become constitutional dimension.
That's sure. If you put a tracking device on someone's car, which is a constitutional intrusion, at least a constitution, it requires some constitutional basis for police to engage in that behavior. I think the legislature is recognizing that this tracking technology does essentially the same thing. It can march you, follow you all the way down the highway, show which exit you're getting off of. And if you go to another facility like a casino where this technology exists, you can follow the person further along. So you may have a stronger argument other than to minimize the nature of the intrusion.
Let me follow one point on that, Judge Ross. This is a single hit. This isn't following somebody. LPR data is limited to a single hit. So it's not tracking them throughout. And it's not multiple hits here, there, and everywhere, and they're not following a person with LPR data. LPR is limited to, under the statute, GPS coordinates of a license plate at a specific time. That's it.
Right, so, but if you have multiple hits, you're essentially tracking. That's all I'm saying. And the legislature uses the term tracking. It's not just monitoring. You're not allowed to monitor or track. So the legislature seems to treat this sort of potential for repetitive monitoring as effectively tracking.
Mr. Zettler, I'm curious about your response to Judge Ross's question of Mr. Nyvold, if this should be precedential. And if it is, what would your syllabus point be?
And I agree with Mr. Nyvold that only, depends which side wins. Since this statute was enacted in 2015, no case has interpreted it. No appellate case has had the issue presented. So, there's that. Obviously, what I take from that is this isn't an issue that is constantly arising since it hasn't come up since 2015 in any appellate or published or unpublished opinion. So what I would urge the court...
That might just mean that Mr. Nyvold is right, that police are doing this so consistently that no one has raised a constitutional or statutory concern. I don't think the fact that no one has got it this far, so up until now, means that police aren't engaging in ongoing behavior that looks or feels like tracking.
Well, to that point, the statute goes into great detail on all of the reporting requirements that law enforcement agencies have to do in order to maintain their ability to possess and use LPR devices. So it's not law enforcement running wild out on the streets, tracking everybody everywhere. There is active monitoring of law enforcement agencies that occurs biannually or even more recently if there's any problems. So there is monitoring of the monitors, if you will. So with that, I would ask the court to simply reverse on the issue of exigent circumstances and remand for trial.
Okay, thank you both for your very helpful arguments this morning. The case is now submitted.